This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Good afternoon. I'm Chris Nolte. On the program today, we have a conversation here in the studio with Tammy Silverman, who's the president and CEO of the Indiana Youth Institute. IYI has several projects going on. One of them is underway this afternoon in East Chicago. We'll find out more. We'll also talk with Michael McCall, who's the chief strategy officer for Fair Oaks Farms in Newton County, about the new hotel that is going in at the facility along I-65. And we'll bring you the latest from the Welcome Project at Valparaiso University. And we'll also have Ed Feigenbaum, who's the owner and editor, at least for now, of the Indiana Gaming Insight newsletter. He'll give us the latest update on the gaming industry in the Hoosier State. That and more coming up. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. From time to time, we enjoy having Tammy Silverman, who's the president and CEO of the Indiana Youth Institute, with us here in Northwest Indiana. In fact, she's here for some meetings today, and we'll find out more about them in just a moment here. Tammy, thank you for stopping by and Regionally Speaking.
It's my pleasure to actually be here with you face-to-face today, so thank you for having me.
Well, usually we do it on the telephone, and that's the phone line's good, but it's nice to have a chance to talk in person.
It's nice to reconnect with old friends, right?
That's right.
We appreciate the opportunity.
One of the things underway right now, there are a number of events right now that the IYI is sponsoring. One of them is underway as we speak right now here during the noon hour. The East Chicago Youth Worker Cafe is underway, and the title of the event this time is called Closing the Achievement Gap. Tell us a little bit about the thinking behind the event and who are some of the people that are involved in it.
Right. Well, the thinking behind the event is all the time we're constantly asking youth workers, teachers, after school providers, all of those folks, what's really on your mind? What could you use help with? What more information could you have? And we've heard that folks are concerned about some of those gaps between different groups of our kids and what their achievement gaps are. And what can we do? More importantly, we can define those gaps, but what can we do to help those kids? And that's what this event is. It's talking about the achievement gaps for sure, which are kind of the performance measurements, of reading proficiencies and math proficiencies and all that kind of testing stuff. But it really then gets into what are the opportunity gaps, because that's where we can jump in and make a big difference.
And we think about achievement gaps here, and we talk mainly about education and about involving teachers and people involved in the public and private school systems. But this goes to beyond these people too. There are any number of people that have contact with young people that need to know this information. So I know this workshop is open to a lot of people.
It is. It's open to anyone who works with kids, right? Because we know, just like you said, and you can tell how expert you are. You've been doing this for a while, that kids need that support network. And that network, of course, includes their teachers, but it also includes their youth group leaders, includes their sports coaches, and includes the people that work with them when they go to a before or after school program. It includes all of that spectrum of adults who can help them in life. And that's why we're talking today, because everybody has the opportunity to make a positive impact.
Mm-hmm. I know that you have one of your own staff members who's leading this workshop today. Tracy Butler has her work cut out for her, I imagine.
She sure does. She sure does. But, this is a deep passion of hers and the organization's, because really part of our mission is to make sure that every single kid in Indiana reaches their full potential. That varies a lot from child to child, what that means and what supports they need. But the reality is we all benefit if every kid grows up to be well-educated, safe, and productive.
Okay. One of the other things we wanted to talk about and have a chance today is to talk about the recent report that is out, which is entitled Race for Results. Tell us about this report and some of the findings from it, please.
Sure. One of the great things, we're really excited to have, this was our first year that we did Race for Results. And you do a great job of helping us get out the Kids Count data every year. Mm-hmm. So in February, the 2018 data, we're editing it right now, that'll be coming out. And then it goes to the national data. What this is kind of that one step further from the Indiana and the national data. Now we're breaking apart some of those big success indicators by different racial groups and by kids that are recent immigrants, and taking a look at what are the differences in those groups, if they exist, and then starting those conversations of what do we do?
Mm-hmm. What have you found so far in some of the information that's come out?
It's not surprising to a lot of the folks, again, teachers, youth workers, all of those folks, but there are disparities between kids of color and white kids and recent immigrants and kids who English as a second language, there are disparities in some of those indicators. And again, what that says to us is, what do we do? You know, how do we start to work to make sure that there is an equitable education? That means that, you know, we have to give some more, maybe we need to give some more internships or shadowing experiences to different kids because those opportunities don't just spontaneously pop up. Maybe we need to provide some different, you know, after-school tutoring opportunities. Maybe we need to provide some sports opportunities that teach teamwork and those kinds of things. I think it's really the start of additional conversations that have been going on for a while, and we really just need to make sure that we're talking about those disparities all the time, as well as saying, the groups that are already doing that work, how can we help you? How can we further your success? And for groups who aren't and that maybe aren't having those conversations, how do we start them?
Now, are the folks participating in the Closing the Achievement Gap workshop today in East Chicago, are they getting some of this information that's come out of the report?
Absolutely. We have copies of the reports for all of them. If they so would like one, you can also go just to our website at IYI.org. There's an electronic version, so anybody can access it and kind of dig through it. We also have a data team. So if there's something that really poured over that data and information, so if you take a look at that report and you're confused by some of the data, if you want some follow-up questions, if you'd like to dig deeper, reach out to us and we'll be happy to do that.
We're talking with Tammy Silverman, who is the president and CEO of the Indiana Youth Institute. She's up here in Northwest Indiana for some IYI sessions today, and we have her in the studios talking. One of the things that you do in part of your job is to put out regular columns, usually on a monthly basis or whenever the mood strikes you, I suppose. But in particular, in November, it's a good way to bring up the opportunity as we talk about this time of year when we're thinking of Thanksgiving in particular, but not only giving thanks, but helping people out. And I know there's an idea, too, that we need to create a philanthropic attitude in young people. Maybe I should say, has it turned out that it seems to have disappeared? We've had it for seemingly forever, but it seems like every generation comes out and maybe it's a little less prominent. Is there any way that we can try to keep that philanthropic attitude alive?
There is. And that's exactly what the column is about, is that just like anything else, like being a good reader, being a good basketball player, being a good piano player, philanthropy and volunteerism and civic engagement, all the same kind of idea, takes practice. And so we need to start that practice with very little kids. In fact, we talked to several experts and they said you can start this and should start it age 3, 4, 5, and then continue on, because the more kids are engaged, not only does that help them understand their community, obviously, but actually that old adage of it's better to give than to receive, kids who volunteer and are philanthropically minded, they have better outcomes as well.
Do we also find that sometimes it depends on the parents and then the other family members, the caregivers, to show the example why the young people should be doing it too?
You got it. Yeah. It's all about modeling. And it's also all about having those conversations. Like I said, with those little kids, some of the suggestions were that if your school or your church is having a canned food drive, actually let the little kids place the food in the boxes. Have them carry it in. Talk to them about the fact that there are hungry people in our community. Have them drop the money in the red buckets. You know, don't just do it as an adult. You need to model it and you need to support them doing it. And you need to talk to them about why we're doing it.
Mm-hmm. Besides the red kettles from the Salvation Army or the food banks that are putting the food drives out there this time of year to help out people that have the worst of the food insecurity, are there any other ideas that the IYI brings up that they should pass along to parents and caregivers to help foster that philanthropic attitude?
Yes. First and foremost, for those little ones, they suggest setting up a bag or a box for your outgrown clothes. And when when you're talking to your child and you see that a t-shirt or whatever is too small, ask them, say, go put that in the box so that we can donate that to people who need clothing. So that's for the little ones. Mm-hmm. As they start to get older, What is recommended is let them identify what's really important and near and dear to them. So, for example, there was a soccer team, and they were having conversations as a team about some other soccer teams in their area that might not have enough soccer balls or shoes, and they did a drive of some of their things and were able to help out another team that was only just down the road, right? And so those soccer players can relate to other soccer players. Kids, maybe there's some kids that have a passion for animals. Maybe there's some kids, there was one case that we looked at that there was a high school student whose grandparents were having trouble. They didn't know how to use email. So he got engaged and really started working with seniors to help them communicate electronically.
That's great. As we have a chance here to talk, we've had a chance to talk about something pleasant. Unfortunately, yes. Let's bring up something that's not quite so pleasant, a very serious topic these days, the opioid addiction crisis that's taken over not only Northwest Indiana, but the entire Hoosier State. And in recent days, we've had comments from Indiana Governor Eric Holcomb, and of course, from President Trump, too, about the opioid crisis. Any thoughts that you have from your standpoint there at the Indiana Youth Institute and what you and your staffers think about, and I'm sure talk about every day?
We talk about it all the time. And in fact, we just put out an issue brief to say what has been that kind of secondary impact on kids. Because what we're seeing is that there are a lot of kids, obviously they're not the addicts, they're not the users, but they're certainly being negatively impacted because maybe they're living in homes where they're not getting the food they need, they're not getting the supervision they need, they're not getting the educational support that they need. So actually, you foreshadowed it perfectly because our next column for December is actually on supporting those grandparents. There have been an awful lot of grandparents and family members stepping in to take care of kids that have been removed from their homes because of opioid use.
And then they've lost parents because they're in treatment or worse yet, they're in prison.
Yeah. Correct. Or they're deceased, unfortunately. Yeah. There's a lot of stories about aunts, uncles, and grandparents who are taking care of kids that they didn't plan for because of the opioid crisis.
On a related topic, we know that this is a tough time of year for many people. Not only do you have to deal with Thanksgiving dinners where maybe you have squabbling relatives talking about things and doing your best not to bring politics into the evening meal, but also, too, this is a time of year where it's very tough for people. In fact, even one of our area hospitals, Methodist Hospitals, is putting out a program on how to be able to reach people and explain to them about the passing of a grandparent or a family member. And it could be because of the opioid crisis or just old age, for among other things, too. What does the IYI, in talking with people about this and working on the workshops on this topic, what do you recommend to people to help try to explain to people about the problems that we all face with the passing of someone we love?
We do. And particularly, you're right, the holidays are really poignant because either you were used to having grandma's special dinner rolls or whatever that was, and maybe those aren't there anymore, or maybe it's just the most recent holiday that somebody that you cared for is no longer there. So again, talking to kids is different than adults. So one, they often say, answer the questions that the kids are asking. So if they ask you a direct question, provide a direct answer. Don't over talk, right? Don't make it a bigger issue than what that child is asking for. And at the same time, always be very straightforward. Kids understand and process a lot more than we give them credit for. And so if they're saying, I'm sad because grandma's not here or Uncle Joe's not here, say, that's okay, I'm sad too. Let them know that it's okay to miss those people and to grieve something that's different.
And we also know, too, that some grown-ups to whom these young people look up to, people like the late Fred Rogers, and even the folks, the cast of Sesame Street, they've had programs that talk about these issues. They bring these things up, so they try to make it easier for young people to understand in the way that they feel they can best tell them about these problems, that people's lives are defined not by the way we always think of it. It's then they're here and then all of a sudden they're gone, sad to say, but it's something that you do have to talk about.
You do have to talk about it. And you know, kids want to talk about it and they want to have a caring adult who will listen to them. So again, rather than saying, don't worry about that, it's going to be a fun Thanksgiving, have that conversation and say, what are you sad about? What are you going to miss? Maybe we want to bring a picture with us of that person. Maybe there's some way we could honor them. Maybe we start, you know, if you miss grandma's cinnamon rolls, let's make them this year. And let's talk about the fun times we had with her as we're making them. Again, you never want to bury the topic or tell the kids it's not okay to talk about something that they are telling you they want to talk about.
And these are always things that you can always find out more about by going onto the IYI website, IYI.org. We have Tammy Silverman, who's the president and CEO of the Indiana Youth Institute, with us to talk about these topics and the workshops that are underway here in Northwest Indiana and more coming up. And you can go on the website and keep track of what's coming up here. If you would like to be involved in something and attend something in the future that happens to be up here in our corner of the state, you can find out on that website where to find it. Tammy, as always, thank you for being with us today.
My pleasure.
Some great things happening at Fair Oaks Farms, happening, of course, in Newton County. And let's find out more about these events coming up. And some big construction projects are going to be underway with a lot of Northwest Indiana players involved in it. Let's talk with Michael McCall, who's the Chief Strategy Officer for Fair Oaks Farms. Michael, thanks for joining us here on Regionally Speaking.
My pleasure. Good to be with you.
Well, some great construction coming ahead here now with the addition to the complex that's out there along I-65 of a hotel. Tell us first the idea, the thinking that you all had there at Fair Oaks Farms about expanding the experience to making it a good destination for people to stop by, not only if they're looking for something interesting to show the family, but an opportunity to bring more people into that particular region of Newton County.
We're following the market. The more we add attractions and things to do at Fair Oaks Farms, the longer the potential length of stay is for our guests, because there's just more to do. You know, many of them said, you know, we'd love to be able to stay overnight, you know, right here and take it in another day or take it in a full day and then move on to, you know, elsewhere in our travels. And then the second piece of it is listening to the market of meeting events. We have a lot of facilities at Fair Oaks Farms. We have, of course, the farmhouse, restaurant, pub, and conference center has a conference center. But then we have a whole array of other facilities around the campus for meetings from as small as, you know, 5 or 6 people to, you know, to 30 people. And then the farmhouse can have hundreds. So that was another thing is we have these facilities, but it would be great. People told us it'd be great to have a place to stay. So we feel like we're just sort of, you know, beginning to round out the experience and the hospitality with this new Marriott Fairfield Inn and Suites.
Now, what interested you folks in attracting Marriott among all the other companies that offer the similar types of lodging?
We did, you know, research the industry and everything. Marriott is the biggest and the best. It's really the strongest reservation system, and you just can't go wrong. And Marriott, I can't say enough about how good it has been to work with them, because they have they understood the opportunity to, while living up to all their standards, to make this a very special place that you know, a bespoke design specifically for Fair Oaks Farms, so that it not only fits in, but it actually extends the identity of Fair Oaks Farms. Mm-hmm. And they've been really terrific to work with.
If you will describe what the architects working for the company have come up with and on how the new hotel is going to look when it's finished.
I'd love to do that. It's you know, in a sense, it's a giant red barn, and it's been designed to fit in very well with the farmhouse, restaurant, pub, and conference center, which it'll be connected to. Mm-hmm. So that's a very key thing, is that it'll be physically connected 100 feet away in an enclosed, air-conditioned, heated connection with a lot of windows going by the oaks of Fair Oaks. There's a beautiful tree right there. It is this giant barn and a milking parlor scaled building. The milking parlors are generally one-story structures attached to, you know, the barns with the cattle and the hay barn loft above. Well, we have a smaller building that is integral to the whole hotel. That is our health club and swimming pool. So it really has the model of a classic, if a bit giant, dairy barn.
Now, I know that this is a project, of course, from a national company when you're talking about Marriott, but you have a lot of Northwest Indiana players that are involved in this at almost every aspect of the planning as well as the construction. Go down the list and tell us about all the companies and businesses that are going to be involved to help make this actually become reality for Fair Oaks Farms.
We sure do have a lot of help from Northwest Indiana. First, it starts out with good hospitality services. they own and or manage 25 plus hotels, so they know this industry extremely well, and they have guided us through the process of working with Marriott and in the design, and they will actually manage the hotel. We have Core Construction out of Schererville. It's a national company, but this is their a very strong office right here, just 20 miles away from the farm. Mm-hmm. And we have DBG Civil Engineering taking care of the stormwater management and all those things and making that look beautiful as well as functional. We've got the Hamster Group is one of the largest subcontractors to Core, and they've built many things at the farm already and are very strong in this area. So we've got a great complement of regional talent coming to bear for us, and we greatly appreciate that.
When you all got together to do the initial planning before the big announcement of the creation of this this great lodging facility that's going to be built along part of the Fair Oaks Farms campus, what ideas did they have? What kind of comments did they have that they wanted to make this, and it certainly is going to turn out that way based on the designs that we've seen so far, to make this a truly unique experience along the same lines as what the entire Fair Oaks Farms complex has really been over the years, hasn't it?
Well, thank you for saying that. All of us wanted to make this, a very special hotel that has the reputation and quality of a Marriott, but is completely unique. And it faces Interstate 65, and you will be able to. We have two silos attached like a barn would. We have these two large silos. And those silos there's two silos and four floors in the hotel. So we have eight opportunities to have some very unique rooms, and those eight silo suites will be very special. We have four of them. We call them family and friends. They'll have bunk beds. We have two of them that will be have a one room conference center, meaning a place for four, five, six people to meet for a meeting right in the room, added on to a conventional room with all the AV support and everything. And then we have something really special, which we have we call it the bridal boudoir, which is a bridal suite so that the bride and the maid of honor and her mom and all of her girlfriends can get ready for a great wedding event that day. So it's a very unique hotel, and the team has, everybody's contributed to the ideas of how to make that unique.
Now, Michael, we have the big announcement of the plans for this this great facility to be built. What's the timetable? When are we likely to like to reserve a room and actually enjoy this this great hotel? It's a few years down the road, but not that far away, I understand.
Yeah, it's about a year and a half. So we will be open for business, we believe, in February of 2019. So we've got about a year and a half. The construction, we had our groundbreaking last Thursday, of course, but the construction's actually started about a month before that. They're busy pouring foundations right today. And so far, things are going very well. And if we can get it open sooner than February, we will. But right now, that's what we're saying, February 2019.
Michael McCall, thanks very much for being with us to tell us about this great event coming up here, and looking forward to watching the project move along the way there along I-65. Thanks for talking about it.
Thank you so much.
Michael McCall is the Chief Strategy Officer for Fair Oaks Farms. Again, Fair Oaks Farms is celebrating the construction of the Fairfield Inn and Suites by Marriott that's going to be going on the Fair Oaks Farms campus there along I-65 in Newton County. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Our next story comes to you from the Welcome Project at Valparaiso University. The Welcome Project collects first-person stories and pairs these with intentional conversation to help forge stronger ties within and across our communities.
I was 19 when I had my son, and I just lost my mom, and we were homeless. We had nobody to help us. It's just so hard to bring a child into that kind of situation, to bring them into a homeless shelter, to have nobody to help you. I don't want him to feel that he can't depend on me. I don't want him to feel that, he has to worry about things like that. I don't want him to feel that it's his fault, or even though he wasn't old enough at the time, but babies can still feel your anxiety. They can still feel your stress. And you don't want them to feel that way. You want them to feel like everything's going to be okay and they don't have to worry, because they're children. They shouldn't have to worry about where they're going to sleep at night or what they're going to eat or anything of that sort. When you have a child, that child comes first. Sometimes he eats, you don't eat. That's just the way it is. Even when you have a job, you only get paid minimum wage, and minimum wage is only $7.25 an hour. And depending on how many hours you get, sometimes your checks are only $200 or $300 every 2 weeks. And that is not enough to get an apartment, to feed your child, to buy diapers, to buy clothes, to have transportation. And when you live in Portage, there's no bus transportation to get people back and forth. And most jobs won't even give you 30 or 35 hours a week. Like the Y, they wouldn't let us work over 30 hours a week. And that was only about $200, $300 every 2 weeks, depending. That's not enough to go out there, put a down payment on an apartment, and pay $600 a month. When we moved into the homeless shelter, Gabriel's Horn, in South Haven, I mean, this homeless shelter was really nice. It was awesome, to be honest with you. You had your own room, had your own little refrigerator in there. The people were really, really nice. They wanted to help you. Yes, things could be complicated, having to get along with other people that you don't know and live with these people and, you know, share the kitchen and the bathrooms and the living room. I mean, you had a curfew of 9 o'clock on the weekdays and 10 o'clock on the weekends. You're allowed to have 3 overnights a month. You could have visitors, but they couldn't go in your room, of course. Kids had to be in bed by 8 o'clock. There was mandatory counseling that you had to do, group counseling and individual counseling. You had chores that you had to do every day before you left the house. If you didn't come in on time, they would lock you out. And after so many write-ups, they would have to put you out. I think it was 5 or 6 write-ups that they would say that, you know, it's time for you to go. They helped with transportation. The house mother, when we moved out, she took Jaden to school for 2 years back and forth and took me to work because I did not have a car. And for 2 years, she still helped us every single day. She would come from South Haven by his school all the way to Portage, pick us up, take us all the way back to South Haven, and take me all the way back to Portage. Every day for 2 years, she did that. So they were really nice people. They had us fill out an application for housing opportunities, and then we were on the waiting list for about 5 or 6 months before we got our apartment. Hanging up pictures on the walls, and hanging up his crafts from school, and decorating his room, and making his room feel like it was his own was probably one of the best memories, because he was really excited when we start putting stuff into place and it became his own room with all his toys and his pictures that he made, and was able to have friends come over and spend the night and play with his stuff. I think being a mom is amazing. Like, you never know how much you can love somebody until you have a child. There's no love like it. Like, sometimes you love them so much that you just cry. There's no love like having a child. You don't feel that way about anybody else. That is truly unconditional love. There's nothing like it.
You can find more regional stories online at welcomeproject.valpo.edu. We recently talked with Portage Police Chief Troy Williams about the ways that his department deals with crime that comes across the state line from Illinois and, in some cases, from Michigan, which is not very far away from LaPorte. And here's what Chief Williams had to say.
The Northwest Indiana region has a lot of vibrant, growing communities. So, unfortunately, you know, you do see some traffic from Illinois that come over here that want to commit some crime. We've come across a few Illinois theft rings and fraudulent check writers. One of the things that we try to do is educate our public. So we're our department is speaking at the Chamber of Commerce breakfast on Thursday, and we'll be meeting with the seniors in town at the Bonner Center, hopefully here in a few weeks. The other thing we try to do is, share information with other departments. There is a monthly detective meeting that in both Lake and Porter County that the detectives go to and share the information and the crimes that are happening so we can kind of stay on top of what's going on, what the trends are.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting that you should mention about the fact that we, of course, always think about the violent crimes, the murders and such that happened, that could happen and come over here. And we know about, of course, on the federal level, what the gangs have done, the establishment that they've had over the years. And we know very much that the former U.S. Attorney David Capp had worked very hard, and his successor is also working very hard in trying to deal with the gangs that have come over and Definitely. Established themselves. So we talk about the violent crimes, but it's interesting you mentioned things about thefts and things like that. Do we find, if it does happen, if the spillage does come over, that it's more of these nonviolent crimes, but still just the same affect residents?
Yeah, any type of crime affects a resident. You know, obviously, depending on the severity of the crime, how much it may affect them. I mean, if you talk to most chiefs or sheriffs around the region, I think they will tell you most of the crime revolves around substance abuse, you know, illegal drugs. Mm-hmm. So, you know, a lot of the theft fuels, you know, that, addicts steal so they can get money to buy their drugs. So again, collectively as a region, we want to be working together to share information, to share trends. You know, if you've got some information about, you know, burglaries in your town, you know, does that translate to what we have in our town? And are they the same suspects? And oftentimes we find out that they are. Mm-hmm. So crime, we know, doesn't stand still. It's not one place. It's going to go around if wherever they can find the weakest point, and so we all got to be working together.
You mentioned the narcotics issue. We're finding, unfortunately, too, that our opioid crisis is a part of that that gets fueled because of the opportunity, or the need for the drugs to come over?
Absolutely. The availability of illegal substances, illegal drugs, unfortunately, is on the rise. You know, prescription pills, one man's opinion, I think, as society, we're probably overprescribed, and it makes it easy to access, especially our kids in school. We have really good SROs that work with the schools to try to combat that. Another thing that we do at the Portage Police Department is to help eliminate some of the theft concerns or being taken advantage of. We've offered our lobby and our parking lot, because they're both video recorded, as a safe trade station.
Oh.
So somebody wants to come in there and do their, you know, online exchange that they purchase something, they can come to our station and do it. It can be a meeting point. If you're coming from Fort Wayne and from Chicago, feel free to use our station.
Great. We've talked in the past about organizations that help deal with the rising crime in general, as well as the crime that may come over from Illinois into Northwest Indiana. And we know that the Northwest Indiana Major Crimes Task Force is very much involved in that. They're more of a reactive agency, though, aren't they? They're looking to find ways to help maybe reduce crime, but they're more concerned about investigating the ones that happened.
That's correct. We have detectives assigned to that task force as well. Again, it's important to work together, share information. If a crime were to happen and a particular community would like to activate them, then they would call the task force commander and do that. Jumping back to the opioid thing you mentioned, we at our department added a third officer to the Porter County Multi-Enforcement Group that goes after the illegal drugs. Mm-hmm. So it was important that we're committing as much as our resources as we can afford to do.
So you're doing what you can, at least on a short-term basis, to do proactive work to be able to find ways to reduce, if not eliminate, the crime.
Yes. Well, short-term and long-term. I took over in 2012, and one of the messages, like, we're not going to tolerate the drug dealers, the gangbangers, and major acts of violence. So when we took over, our SWAT team was one of our focuses, and in the first year, we had like 22 activations. The second year was 20, and now last year in 2016, it was probably 4, and this year I think we've had 1. So I think that goes to show where we had four consecutive year drop in crime, a slight rise in 2016, but we were down many, many officers. But still yet the third lowest total in the last 20-some years. Just continuing to stay on top of that, educating the public, being transparent as a department so that, you know, our community, you know, trusts us and they know they can come to us if they had a question or concern.
We're talking with Portage Police Chief Troy Williams as we continue our conversation into the spillage of crime, major and minor, if you want to refer to it as such, that comes from Illinois over into Northwest Indiana. And one of the concerns I know, Chief, is that you want to be sure that you build a good relationship with the community, and police officers work very hard at that. We know in the urban communities it's more difficult, but what do you feel that at least what you try within your role there as the Portage Police Chief to help strengthen that relationship?
You know, I think we're pretty fortunate. We have a lot of our officers, you know, they live in Portage, they grew up there, they're obviously raising their families, so when their kids get involved in like different youth organizations or sports teams, you know, they see these officers at different events. We do host a Citizens Academy and a Youth Explorers program, so that's another way to outreach with the community. We just recently, back in October of 2016, moved into a new police department building. It's the former University Center downtown. Mm-hmm. So that allows us – it's not your typical police department. It's not kind of – it's not drab. It's not walled off or anything. It's very open and inviting. And I think that's important when you're, you know, walking into a police department. So we have also National Night Out coming August 1st down at Founders Square, and most communities, police departments do that around the country, and so we'll be bringing out all our specialty equipment, our canines, SWAT team, to let the citizens and the kids and everybody come take a look at it.
You talk about being a close part of the Portage community and trying to not only tell people that you're there if they need the assistance, but also, too, to show that you're part of the community. You're as much a resident of Portage as they are. And do you get any good response from residents when you have these opportunities to get together?
It's funny you say that. I just got a card in the mail today, actually, mm-hmm. from a resident who just wanted to thank us for the job that we do. She's like, you know, as a woman, I've lived here many, many years. I just wanted to reach out and let you all know that you do a great job here if no one's telling you. And, you know, we get complimented pretty regularly, and we're pretty, you know, happy with that. And that doesn't mean we can't make a mistake, you know, along the way. And if we do, then we want to correct those things. We don't want to rest on our laurels, and we want to try to, you know, continue to build on the relationships that we have. And, again, let the community know we're there to help them.
I know it may not be the case necessarily in the city of Portage, but in other communities here in Northwest Indiana, the relationship is still strained between police officers and the public. Some of it is because of years of distrust, and it can happen, and it's difficult to be able to change those ways. I know that's come up like that. Is there anything in particular that you and your officers work on to help try and as you say, strengthen, certainly between strengthening that bond between community and the police departments, but also just as citizens?
Sure. You know, I would agree with you. I think there is, you know, somewhat of a national movement that, you know, different areas of the country maybe not necessarily happy with some of the, you know, police involvement that they've had. I think as you see, as things bear out, the police have been found to be justified in some of the things. However, we want as a community to be transparent. And so we, you know, have these programs, again, the Citizens Academy, Youth Explorers, and those types of things. One of the things that we do, I think we're very successful with, is our social media outreach. Our mm-hmm. Facebook page has nearly 17,000 likes on it. And when we get a video or a picture of a suspect from a crime, we will put it on there. And I'll bet you our solve rate is 95% from the public. And usually within the first day, it's that crime is solved. So that lets the residents know, hey, we're actively trying to, you know, work for you to get this issue solved, but we can't do it alone. We need your eyes and ears, and we've been very successful at that.
Does it seem that, certainly in this case in particular, I'll be using the Facebook page to get the information out about crimes and about people that are wanted in connection with the crimes, that people are more apt to participate that way? It's anonymous, but you're not completely anonymous.
You can't be anonymous because they can send us a private message, so they don't necessarily have to post something, you know, in the public commentary. But it allows them to remain private. You know, we do allow, you know, commentary on there. I think that's important. We would try to answer, you know, questions as they come up. And now we may not always agree on something, but it allows our community to voice their concerns or their opinions, and us to, you know, understand how they're feeling. And I think if we, you know, continue to do that, we can only get better together.
Now, we've talked here, in fact, at the start of our conversation, about some of the activities coming up here that the Portage Police Department is working to get more people involved in the community with the department and help out. Is there anything in particular that you, and in talking with Mayor Snyder and other people in the City Council, that you would like to do with the police department to be able to strengthen that tie a little better?
You know, we're always looking for new and innovative ideas to reach out to the community. I said an annual one, which we have coming up, is the National Night Out. Mm-hmm. So we will have a big display out that night. I know the Porter County Fair is around the corner. We'll probably have some officers out there, maybe some of our specialty equipment. You know, especially, you know, kids like those things. You know, we encourage our officers, although the school's out, school gets back into session, to go read at the schools. A lot of times we get invited to do that. So anytime we can have a positive interaction with the community, we want to do that.
Do you think that these efforts have helped kind of keep the crime spillage from getting this far to the east as Portage?
I think so. I mean, I challenge a community to say that they have no crime. I mean, so it's how you're going to address it. And I think if you do it proactively but in conjunction with your community, then you're both going to win. Like I said, we've been fortunate. We had a four-year drop that never happened, you know, four consecutive year that had never happened before. Slight rise this last year, but still at the third lowest ever. So that tells me that we and the community are doing something right.
That's Portage Police Chief Troy Williams here on Regionally Speaking from Lakeshore Public Radio.
Hi, this is Susanna Hoff of the Bengals.
Hey, everybody, this is Greg Hannon with Tesla.
Hello, kiddies. This is Alice Cooper with Tom Lounges.
This is Herman Rarebell, formerly of the Scorpions, and you are listening to Tom Lounges.
Come join Tom Lounges on Midwest Beat as he covers music, arts, and the people who make it. Fridays at noon and Tuesdays at 7 on 89.1 Lakeshore Public Radio.
Well, it's been an up-and-down year for the revenue-making Northwest Indiana casinos, as well as the rest of the casinos in the Hoosier State. And to find out how things are shaping up and look ahead to the future, perhaps, we have with us, as always, Ed Feigenbaum. He is the fellow who's the editor and creator of the Indiana Gaming Insight newsletter, a number of newsletters that he runs out of his office in Indianapolis area. Ed, thanks for being with us today.
Well, thank you, Chris, although I must say I'm disappointed that Susanna Hoff of the Bengals didn't give me a personal introduction and I had to get it from you.
Well, actually, she gave it to Tom Lounges, whose show she had been on. So I guess that's the only reason. If you're not on Tom's show, you don't get the message or don't get the mention, I suppose. So that's the way show business is, I suppose. So.
Yeah, or maybe it's because I don't have really good news for the gaming industry in Northwest Indiana for October. Maybe that's why I don't get the good credit here.
Could be. I know the Indiana Gaming Commission had kind of up and downs in the November and October, and hopefully November will be better. We'll find out, of course, the end of this month in particular. But I know that the casinos around here had about not quite a 2% drop from 1 year earlier. So I guess that, you know, but I also know too that some of the casinos are looking at more positively at it. They felt that. At least some of them felt that they did do an increase in revenue compared to the others in the region up here. The latest I know that Horseshoe Casino in Hammond was one of supposedly only two casinos here in the area that actually posted a revenue increase, and the other one was the Majestic Star Boat Number 1 in Gary.
Well, you've stolen all my thunder. Come on, sorry, Chris.
Well, you can give us the great details. I just have the headline, so to speak, here.
You're absolutely right. The Horseshoe Casino in Hammond and Majestic Star Casino 1 were the only two to show any kind of increase in the Northwest Indiana area. And the win, which is about $76 million, a little bit more than that, declined both from 2016 and from September. So that's not encouraging. But the good news out of this is that it really was a function of the calendar more than anything. The calendar for October 2017 had one less Saturday and one more Tuesday, and I think that really contributed. You look at the loss of a weekend day as perhaps about a 1.5% decrease in casino revenue statewide. So really, you have to say that the numbers were about equal to October 2016. But there was a lot of variety and a lot of volatility between the casinos. And we're also starting to see a little bit of differentiation again between the mother of all boats there in Hammond and the other casinos, because Hammond grew on a year-over-year basis for what's now the sixth month in a row, and that's not only real good news for Northwest Indiana. That's also the longest active streak in the state.
Wow.
And the other casinos are just not showing that kind of a growth pattern. And Horseshoe's also seeming on a monthly basis to outpace the Chicagoland increases when there is an increase and do a little bit better than the decreases both in Chicagoland and in Northwest Indiana. But you look at some of the other casinos, the second Majestic Star Casino Boat, Blue Chip's having kind of a tough period. This is their lowest October win since 1997, and 1997 was the first October that boat was even in the water. Ameristar had a tough month as well. It was their lowest total win in more than a year, is 13 months. It was their second lowest October win for the century. But, and here's news for you, Chris. Here's news for listeners of Lakeshore Public Radio. On Thursday, Ameristar is going before the Indiana Gaming Commission, and they're going to be asking for permission to do something that no other casino has really done before in the state. Under the new land-based casino law, where you've seen now Tropicana Evansville move just this last month to a landside facility from a riverboat casino on the Ohio River, under that law, casinos are permitted to either move their entire gaming floor, all their gaming amenities, to a new landside facility, or they can ask the Gaming Commission for permission to do things kind of in increments. And what Ameristar is going to be doing is asking the Gaming Commission for permission on Thursday to move some of their poker game operations, more than just poker games, some of their entire table game operations off of the boat and into their ancillary facilities, the pavilion and hotel. What I think you're going to hear is that they want to have some flexibility to move their high limit room to the landside facilities and be able to free up a little bit more space on the boat for different kinds of games and to make it a little bit more amenable to the patrons there, while at the same time being able to offer a much nicer atmosphere for their VIPs and what they call the VVIPs, the real VIPs, in that high limits room. And the Gaming Commission will probably make them, will certainly make them adhere to all kinds of surveillance and security requirements. And it's going to be interesting to see, because this will be the first time that a casino is going to be doing something like this or asking for something like this. It'll be interesting to see what kinds of additional restrictions would be imposed. But it's something that would be a big plus for Ameristar and will enable them to make their casino a little bit more friendly toward the big money players.
Do you think that maybe that they're doing this too, not only to get this one up on all of their competition here in Northwest Indiana, but they're also doing it to kind of show the folks at Horseshoe that even though you've got that great venue over there, that you draw in a lot of people come in for the shows and the like, and in turn stick around, I'm sure, to play the games, that you're not the only show, not the only boat in town, so to speak.
Well, absolutely. I don't know that they're looking at bringing in more business, but I think that they're looking at being a little bit more competitive. And since you raised the question of Horseshoe, when Horseshoe, for example, last month brought in the World Series of Poker circuit event to Hammond, to the casino there, they were able to host that in the venue. They didn't have to put that in their poker room or bring it onto some other place in the casino floor and move other tables or equipment. They were able to use an existing facility that's their entertainment facility. Well, the Ameristar doesn't have that kind of ability, on their boat, and because their boat is different than the mother of all boats in Hammond, they can't really reconfigure things like that. So if they want to have a major kind of tournament like that, they need to be able to have a place in which to host it, and this may potentially be the type of facility that will enable them to do those types of things, host those types of events going forward.
Well, they may try and snap it away from the Horseshoe Casino next year, then, whenever their new room is done.
Well, I don't know that that's necessarily going to be the case, but there are a lot of these different kinds of traveling poker events that attract a lot of interest, and certainly there's the ability to bring people in from the Chicagoland area and not even necessarily impinge upon the kind of crowd that Horseshoe would bring in for the World Series of Poker, which is one of those trademark kind of events in a couple of senses. You know, it is literally a trademarked proprietary mark of some entity nationally, and this is one of those circuit events. But there are all kinds of other tournaments that Ameristar may be able to bring in.
Right.
You know, if they get approval for something like this on Thursday.
Now, do you see that if they do get this permission, and of course go through the procedure of having to make sure that they're following all the rules and regulations under the new law, that you might see some other casino boats, not only in Northwest Indiana but elsewhere in the state, make some moves, make some improvements since they have the new law to work with?
Oh, absolutely. And this is something that was anticipated when the land-based casino law was being contemplated. There were different casinos that came in and said, you know, well, we're not necessarily interested in making the huge capital investment that we might have to make in order to actually, you know, set up a whole new facility. It was a $50 million facility that Tropicana just moved into in Evansville. But, you know, there are some things that we'd like to do in terms of reconfiguring our pavilion, our hotel, and ancillary facilities right there on the footprint. That certainly wouldn't require, you know, an eight-figure investment like that. And we'd like the flexibility to do that. And that's what the casino execs were telling legislators in some of the House and Senate committee hearings back in 2015 and 2016.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of the lawmakers, do you think that we're going to see anything else come up here in the 2018 General Assembly session that might involve not only the gaming industry but other related industries here?
Well, I'm sure that you're going to see all kinds of tinkering at the margins or attempts to tinker at the margins in terms of gaming in 2018, courtesy of the General Assembly. But I think the one big thing that would have been on the table was the potential for a casino in Terre Haute. And that seems to be a little bit further on the horizon now. The company that was trying to get that to come to fruition last year just told analysts in a conference call last week that they really don't see the opportunity for that in 2018, but believe that 2019 is their opportunity. And I think you'll also see another quiet push for live table games at the two racinos in Anderson and Shelbyville to try and accelerate the process that allows them to have that in 2021. You know, now that Governor Pence is vice president, you know, he was the guy who was standing in the way of that. And the reason that the bill passed with the 2021 trigger was because that would have been at the end of a second Pence term, and he would have been gone by then, and that way he had no objection. They would like to accelerate that. There are some other competitive properties that would like to see that 2021 day be the earliest possible date. You know, there will also be all kinds of economic development initiatives that will be introduced by the governor. You know, you'd asked about other things for Northwest Indiana.
Right.
The governor is laser-focused, as he says, on workforce development initiatives and other economic development tools. And you are going to see a significant emphasis by the General Assembly in terms of following those kinds of things. And in particular, you know, the career and technical education components of the governor's legislative agenda will be of great interest to the manufacturing industries in Northwest Indiana and Lake County in particular, which and Porter County as well. You know, and we just saw that, you know, ArcelorMittal is going to be expanding there as well in Burns Harbor. They are going to want to have better educated employees who are going to be able to actually compete in the workforce of the future. You know, it's not the kind of situation anymore where somebody can come in with a basic high school education, and even the high school education that they want people to have before some kind of certificate or certificated program, certificated credentials, will be more of a STEM-based high school education, so that people will come in with greater skills into that workforce.
Well, you know, Ed, I'd like to have a chance to get together again and talk again soon here, in particular about the workforce development issues that you just brought up here and how we're likely to see some changes out of Indianapolis. We're out of time for today, though. We appreciate you talking, and we appreciate the information, knowing the latest about what Ameristar Casino in East Chicago wants to do. We've been talking with Ed Feigenbaum, who is the creator and editor of the Indiana Gaming Insight newsletter. As always, talk to you soon. Thank you.
Appreciate it, Chris.
And thank you for listening to Regionally Speaking for the day. I'm Chris Nolte. We'll be back with you tomorrow.